This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Last week I read the prelude to Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival by Carl Safina. And I enjoyed that so much. I enjoyed his writing so much that I'm going to read excerpts from the first chapter. And before that, I want to tell you a little more about the author, Carl Safina. He's a MacArthur Fellow and a 1998 winner of the Lannan Award, and is the founder and director of the Living Oceans Program at the National Audubon Society. He has a website, carlsafina.org, with a blog and all kinds of up-to-date information. This Albatross book was published in 2002, so he's been busy since then. He also has established a nonprofit organization called the safinacenter.org, with a podcast and a blog. I always enjoy those. And they're very up to date. Many entries in July. He has a fellowship program that helps launch the professional careers of young people who will carry their important work into the coming decades. Lots of interesting things here. So to get back to Albatross, he's taken a small plane from the Hawaiian Islands north and west, into the chain of islands that are also part of the Hawaiian chain. For hours, they've been flying, and they land at a wildlife research center. The place is called the French Frigate Shoals. It's just a tiny dot on the map, and the French Frigate Shoals are populated with many species of ocean birds breeding there, and researchers who are trying to learn all they can from these birds. So you'll hear different names mentioned as we go along. Though it's just after New Year's, it's hot here, but this great city of birds provides ample distraction from the heat. Over the barracks, red-tailed tropic birds, so pearly they seem to glow, are hovering and backing up in the breeze, displaying their superb tail streamers to each other, shifting them first to one side, then the other, calling attention to their slender, exquisite elegance. These displays are supposed to look sexy, and, well, all I can say is it works for me. On the ground, you can see that their gleaming white bodies are infused with a peachy bloom, offset by striking black feet and a black stripe that passes through their eyes and then curls to a stunning comma, as if the red tail is some mythic Egyptian creature. We walk along the airstrip, the only place on the island reserved for people. Sleek, fluttering, dove-sized black noddies create perpetual motion commuter air traffic at eye level, carrying seaweed for new nests. They crowd the leathery-leaved beach heliotrope and naupaka bushes like big figs, making the branches seem fruit-laden. Upon landing, they invariably open their mouths to flash their bright red-orange tongues and oral interiors. How very odd. The gesture must convey something important enough to say constantly. They let you close enough to admire their ashy crown and the white eyeliner around the trailing edge of their eyes. While black noddies nest in bushes, barely bigger brown noddies nest on the ground. While blacks are hyper, browns seem quiet, reserved, going along and getting along. All these subtle differences and little puzzles that mark the boundaries of closely related species offer abundant delights for eye and mind. Most bushes are rimmed with crow-sized red-footed boobies atop their stick nests. Their most common colors, they vary a bit, include red web feet, black wingtips, and powder blue bills. A few redfoots are a lovely, creamy café au lait morph. If you move in close but stay out of pecking range, you can see the subtle pink pastels at the base of their bills and the pink eyeshadow skin around their eyes. Masked boobies hail us from little pebble nests on the ground. These guys are incredibly handsome. Immaculate white body, tail tip and outer wing feathers night black, black mask, bright yellow eye with black dot pupil, bright yellow matching bill. Their stares seem quizzical, a little apprehensive. What's in a name? Plenty. Names, especially a name like Boobies, impart bias. Temperate region members of the same family are called gannets, and everyone thinks they're oh so graceful, which they are, and that their diving skill is wow, how spectacular, which it is. Tropical members of the family, equally graceful and spectacular, are called boobies, and everyone titters and thinks they're amusing. These birds, misnamed boobies, are hard-driving, plunge-diving, weapon-tipped missiles built to kill. Their stout, straight, sharp, serrated bills inflict real damage to any flesh, be it a flying fish or a hand. Around here, boobies get respect. All the animals here are tame because, present company excluded, the place lacks land mammals. So the animals' minds lack the paw print of fear. Tame means unafraid, but not friendly. They either ignore or scold you as you pass, extend a hand to see whether a noddy is incubating an egg, and rather than flee, it vigorously bites. No serious harm from its tweezery bill. But you get the point. This is their place, and they're not scared of you. Their fearlessness makes this seem like paradise without predators. But watch closely. A tern chick is vulnerable to a frigate bird. Rummaging ruddy turnstones and bristle-thighed curlews will happily peck open an egg if granted a chance. And each of the seemingly pacifist seabirds turns predator at sea. Paradise depends on which side of an appetite you find yourself. Great whirling clouds of sooty terns are gathered overhead, and they will stay aloft all day, not landing until about sunset. They are patterned, striking, black above and white below, with elegant forked tails and a white forehead. Their squeezed toy call sounds like they're saying, "Wide awake, wide awake." About 10,000 of them have returned so far. These constitute only the vanguard, perhaps a tenth, of the eventual breeders, merely the first breath of a living hurricane that will nest several months hence. The rest remain at sea. You would think the birds flying overhead would be more anxious to land, because all the while they are at sea, they apparently fly non-stop and never rest. They land only to breed. Juveniles appear to fly continuously for up to 5 years, before they touch down for their first nesting attempt. No wonder landing seems like a big deal for them. Here in the extreme ocean, many of the birds are built for ultimate flight efficiency. Land is almost an afterthought in their design. Tropic birds are so aerial, they're crippled on the ground. To reduce wing loading for travel far offshore, they have traded away leg muscle. They cannot stand. Shoving along the ground with both feet, they push themselves forward piteously, thudding their breast with each step. Strange and severe. Their close neighbors and distant relatives, the frigate birds, have enormous wings for their size, quite possibly the greatest sail area to body weight ratio of any birds. For a bird with a 6-foot wingspan, great frigate birds are extraordinarily light, 3 pounds, a mere kilogram and a half. Their feathers reputedly weigh more than their skeletons. Frigate birds' feet are nearly as useless as tropic birds. Frigate birds can't land on water, can't swim, can't walk. Their sharp clawed toes are strictly designed as clamps for holding branches when they land. Frigate birds are built to fly and geared to snatch food, and that's it. But what frigates do, they do devastatingly well. At sea, frigate birds make a living chasing and robbing other birds, threatening them with their hooked bills until they drop or disgorge the fish they've caught. Most birds are smart to distrust them and to not leave chicks unguarded. Look up at these dark frigate birds, their forked tails streaming, their long crooked wings recurved, flying crossbows. They evince a grace most sinister. A dozen of them are cruising back and forth in the uplifting cushion of breeze on the windward side of the island. A booby commits the mistake of returning to the island right here. One frigate immediately makes chase, and a pack quickly follows. The booby attempts evasions, but the frigate twists expertly, locked in like a heat-seeking missile. Now other frigates close in, and the booby cuts its losses, coughing up its tithing. The falling fish is immediately snatched by Frigate One. I catch a blur out of the corner of my eye and put my head down just in time for a masked booby to slam into me so hard that it slaps the reinforced brim of my cap against my face, then falls dazed to the ground. Its penalty for not watching where it was going. It must have had its eye on the frigates. Had I not been wearing a hard-brimmed cap, I might have gotten skewered in the face by its carrot-sized bill. The bird picks itself up from the ground and flies off again. Frigate birds not airborne crowd the highest bushes. It's their mating season, and the dark-bodied males have their erotic, heart-shaped, scarlet throat sacs inflated, hoping to attract a female. With those swollen throats tautly distended, they sit shockingly unashamed, overtly sexual, falsely nonchalant, quiet and smug in the knowledge of their own sexiness, yet always a little insecure about whether they're attractive enough and whether they have what it will take to make it in the fierce competition for a mate. One female, on a mere flyby, immediately sets all the males a-quiver. Now she lands among one group of blooming males like a thorn among roses, and the inflated admirers are going mad with lust, shaking their outstretched wings, rocking their heads side to side, jiggling those big swollen balloons, and uttering spooky, wavering howls. Despite the scarlet intensity of the male's desire, the female looks utterly disinterested. But she's landed for a reason, and she's making her calculations. Who seems strongest? Who looks oldest and has survived longest? Who has won the best spot on this bush? Is anyone here good enough for me? She sizes up the suitors. Then she simply departs, leaving a wake of shaking, rattling, howling males. Along the beach berm, sleeping like yellow logs under the bushes, lie several Hawaiian monk seals, rare and endangered animals that inhabit only these islands. And on the wet lower sand, lapped and lulled by wavelets from the lagoon, naps a male green turtle of impressive heft, perhaps 300 pounds. This chain of islands is one of the very few places remaining on Earth where non-nesting sea turtles still regularly bask on beaches during daylight. One sooty tern is lying on the dry sand. Life has left it. I pick it up by its pick-like bill and run my fingers along its soft, feathered contours. It is an immaculate death, bright, sleek, so lovely that its corpse invites contact, offers assurance that close admiration will not disturb. It seems in excellent health, save that it's dead. We envision collision with another tern during darkness with fatal consequence. Patty asks to see it and takes it gently from my hands. Stroking the dead tern, Patty says, I know there are many important reasons for conservation, but I think mainly we care about nature because of its beauty. Albatrosses aren't the most numerous birds here, but on wings spanning 7 feet, they get your attention. Two species of albatross breed here, the lazen albatross and the black-footed. Every few minutes, a bird who's been at sea crosses the pale tropical flats. Some arrive over your head on their immense bowed wings. Others come low, almost touching the sand. The tips of their long wings curve down conspicuously, like the head of a pickaxe. At this close range, they seem on the far side of enormous. One lazen albatross is coursing airily up and down the island's shore, zooming half a mile with each directional change. It does this for many minutes on end. We can speculate on the costs of this seeming waste of energy, but this bird challenges us to explain the benefits. I sense the exertion of a joy so sheer and light it embodies the most time-tested truths. Some albatrosses land awkwardly, coming a little too fast, having trouble arresting their momentum, hitting the vegetation and rolling forward on their chest. But usually they land skillfully, impressive if you consider they haven't touched firm ground for weeks. No welcoming committee awaits, no fanfare, just a mate at the nest who has sat incubating throughout the time the arriving bird wandered at sea. At this reunion and relief, no rejoicing ensues. The mate actually seems reluctant to yield custody. That's surprising. After 3 weeks of incubation, you'd think hunger and prolonged endurance and sheer boredom would grow unbearable, and they'd veritably spring from the nest at first sight of their mate. But no, old habits die hard, and arriving birds sometimes have to shove their spouses off the nest. Dave, Patty, Anthony, and I are watching one such homecoming albatross trying to relieve its mate. Anthony interprets, "A lot of times it takes them half an hour to switch. It can take hours, one trying to walk onto the egg and the other trying to stay put, like they're in a trance to incubate." Unquote. When an albatross finally departs, it needs a lot of running room. Some run the width of the runway, about 40 yards, before getting airborne. They run along with their outstretched wings, waving, 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 always into the wind, if there is any breeze at all, and patter along with their feet loudly slapping the ground. Eventually, the job of defying gravity shifts from their feet to their wings, and they are off and magnificent. In the siege of space-time that is jet travel, it's easy to forget just how much water separates Hawaii from the continents. The Hawaiian chain comprises the most isolated islands on Earth. No other islands are so far from any mainland. And consider this, the Hawaiian chain is so disconnected from the rest of the ocean that one-third of its reef fish species are found nowhere else on Earth. Of the hundreds of Pacific coral species, fewer than 10% have ever reached the Hawaiian Islands. No land mammal, and only one bat, ever reached the islands. So few birds reached Hawaii that most of its native land birds actually evolved on the islands, adapted descendants of those stray fragments of flying DNA that were the few birds blown so far off course. Even by Hawaiian standards, the remotest part of the Hawaiian archipelago is this string of islands and atolls called the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands. They stretch more than 1,000 miles west from what you usually think of as Hawaii. They include a series of isolated dots and dabs in the wide sea. Rocks and atolls and other shards of barely emergent land you may never have heard of. Nihoa Island, Necker, French Frigate Shoals, Gardner Pinnacles, Morro Reef, Lazen Island, Lisianski Island, Pearl and Hermes Reef, Midway Atoll. The only famous member, flashpoint of the pivotal World War II sea battle, and Kure Atoll. These 10 little exiled lands range in size from Morro's Reef's single emergent rock and Gardner Pinnacle's 3 dry acres to Midway's 2.3 square miles, anchored in a deep sea, yet adrift in deep time, on Earth's floating crust. These islands have become terra firma's tiny outposts to the northwest, far from surfboards, bikinis, package tours, June honeymoons, and the rest. Though little and remote, they're crammed with seabirds, 6 million breeding seabirds of 18 species. If you count juveniles and non-breeders, the number balloons to 14 million. Having just 0.1% of Hawaii's land area, they provide breeding ground for 95% of its seabirds. This includes some 600,000 breeding pairs of Lazen albatross and 60,000 black-footed albatross pairs, virtually their entire world populations. The sheer concentration of birds makes the density of life here hugely impressive. Tern Island, where we are, is among this holy group of isles. Its parent atoll, French Frigate Shoals, is a roughly circular rock and coral platform nearly 20 miles wide, dotted with scarcely dry land. Though it is the largest of the chain's atolls, Most of French Frigate is the underwater lagoon. Tern Island, though less than a mile long, is the largest island here. Most of the others are too small for a long stroll and often get washed over. But these tiny sites are the reproductive generators of wildlife inhabiting many millions of square miles of ocean, including U.S. waters, other nations' territories, and the high seas. In other words, without these safe havens, wildlife populations throughout the North Pacific would shrivel. So although the area of these dollops of land is a trivially tiny fraction of the ocean's total realm, the ecological footprint of the islands is enormous, vast as the sea itself. And I'll stop there. I'm reading the first chapter titled Greetings from the book written by Carl Safina, Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival. This was a John Burroughs Medal Award-winning book in 2003. And I thought I knew something about Hawaii. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.